talked to her for quite a while, and it just proves to me what we talked about, that this program really does work, and I'm not going to take up any more of her time. Is Shirley T. from Hueytown, Alabama.
Good morning. My name is Shirley Templin, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July the 29th, 1982. I am an 11 in this group, in this fellowship, and I am so grateful to be here. I want to thank so many people. This is our third visit to Jackson Mill, and we always enjoy coming here, no matter what time of the year. And for those of you who would like to hear rebuttal, you will be able to tonight at 8 o'clock. And for those of you who haven't met my husband, I'd like for him to stand up. He's my driver. He drove me to drinking. He drove me to treatment. And a lot of times drives me to these meetings. We happen to fly up here this weekend. Bo, you want to stand so they'll know who to hit? Bo is also my best friend. I could say a lot of things about him this morning. This past April the 30th, we celebrated anniversary number 29. Now, I don't remember all of these 29 years. He does. Every single one of them. But with the help of these programs, Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and Alateen, we were able to put this relationship back in order like Marietta last night. I think it's beautiful to invest what you have in the one you've got, you know, and keep that. When I said that one night at a meeting and somebody said, "Does this mean I can go get a divorce?" And I said, "Not on my part." Well, I'm here to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I'm going to borrow one of my daughter's opening statements when she talks and shares, and she says, the more you cry, the less you pee. So I brought my Kleenex. We're going to do a lot of that. Early in this program, my story started out with a lot of crying, and it ended with an awful lot of laughter and happiness. And these past 11 years, my story has kind of changed a little bit. And my story's a little funny at the beginning now, when I look back on it, and it's a little sad at the end. But that's okay. It's okay to cry in this program. I've learned that. And you're going to love me anyway, and I'm grateful for that. I am the oldest of three children. I have a brother that's 4 years younger than I am, and a sister 8 years younger than I am. And my brother is not an alcoholic. My sister is trying her very best to be. She's working on her story right now, somewhere in Tennessee. we're waiting on her. But I was 38 years old when I found this program. I'm going to go ahead and give you my age like Marietta did last night. I will be 49 in 2 weeks. And I'm proud of it. You know, when I was drinking, I didn't think I'd live that long. And I'm just so grateful to be approaching 49 and be sober in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved my life. There was an awful lot of drinking in this house, this home, and the day I graduated from elementary school and was 13 years old, my parents signed the divorce papers, and we thought we got the problem out of the house. you know, I can remember growing up. I remember one particular Easter that I'll never forget. My dad had stayed out all night drinking, and when he came in the next morning, the first thing my mom said was, "Did you get the Easter baskets?" And my daddy said, "No." And my mother said, "You mean you didn't bring these children an Easter basket?" He said, "No." And I thought, how could someone let drinking be that important in their life? You know, and I remember the times when he came home from work real late and no money, and my mother had a difficult time, but but she always did the best that she could. And when they signed these divorce papers, you know, I think it gave all of us a sense of relief. My mother announced that we were moving in with her parents, my grandmother and granddaddy, and I was the oldest grandchild, and I was spoiled rotten, and I don't mind telling anybody that, and when and if I ever do have a grandchild, they will be spoiled rotten too. I just believe in that. look how I turned out, you know. But I can remember thinking all the way moving into my grandparents' house, which is a couple of blocks from ours, I'm going to be okay. I will be okay. My granny will take care of me, and she will teach me things that young ladies need to learn. And she will love me, and she made all my clothes for me. And I didn't think anything in the world was going to stop me from growing up to be the way I was supposed to be. In September of that year, I started to high school. And I had a whole new set of friends and got to ride the school bus to school and changed in, you know, two times going to school. And just, it was a whole new ball game. And I didn't have to worry about my daddy coming in drunk at night. It was so nice and peaceful at this house. And the first Christmas we were there was the best Christmas I'd had in my 14 years. The very best Christmas I ever had. And there was no one falling in the Christmas tree, and there were an awful lot of presents, and there was an awful lot of laughter and a lot of fun. And I thought, now this is the way you're supposed to live. The following month, in January, my granny suddenly became ill, and within a matter of a couple of weeks, in fact, at the end of January, at the age of 50, she died of cancer. And I just did not understand. I knew why my daddy was no longer around, but please, somebody tell me why this lady that was going to take care of Shirley and make sure that she grew up to be a young lady was gone. And I didn't understand it. I do understand, though, that my granddaddy sat my mom down at the kitchen table and said to her, Louise, you have three small children, and if you're going to live under my roof, honey, you need to get a job. See, as long as Granny was there, my mom didn't have to worry about it. And my mom said, well, I tell you what, Dad, I'll get a job and we'll move out. That's where I get my independence from my mom. But we moved out, and my mom got a job working the night shift. And my mom and I sort of switched roles, and I became the mother and she became the daughter, simply because I was always there to take care of my younger brother and sister. I'd scoot home from school in the afternoons to make sure they got their homework, had dinner, and had clean blue jeans the next day for school. And you know, that meant that I didn't go to girlfriends' houses in the afternoon after school, or I didn't go to football games or pep rallies. Things that the other kids were doing, but it didn't seem to bother me. I guess I kind of like that authority. Because you see, I had my brother and sister and myself in bed, and my mother got home at night, and then we would get up and go to school the next morning, and my mom would be at us late. That was just the way it was. On Saturdays and Sundays, we would spend the time shopping and everything. During the week, I was a mother, and my mother and sister minded me. Sometimes. But I can remember, you know, my head and night on the first date. And I said, why? I mean, if nothing was going to happen on a blind date anyway, I didn't see the harm. But she said, now good girls don't kiss their, you know, first date goodnight when they walk them to the door. And, you know, I sort of believed everything my mom said. So when Bo walked me to the door that night, he tried now. But I told him, you know, I just pushed him away and walked in, and my mom said, "Well, how did you like him?" And I said, "I'm going to marry him one of these days." And she looked at me and she said, "He probably won't even call you back." And I wondered then why I didn't kiss him. I went on to bed, and I think I cried myself to sleep that night thinking, well, he's not going to call me back. And the next day after he came in from church, he called me, and we had a date on Sunday night. And I've learned in this program a few things about honesty, and I have to tell you that we had a date on Sunday night, and as soon as he picked me up, and before we got to the corner, I let him kiss me. And he's been kissing me ever since. We dated for 5 years. And during this time, his parents divorced, not for drinking problems, but for others. And here we were, two young people madly in love, and we knew we wanted to get married. We knew we were in love. And, you know, that's the one thing that I have to stop and tell you right now, this disease called alcoholism that reared its ugly head in our home. Bo and I had some little something called love that started from the very beginning. And the best way I know to describe it is like a gas stove. None of the eyes were on, but the little pilot light was always burning. It never went out. And when we were able to get to you people, and you taught us how to love each other once more and put this relationship back together, today all four of those eyes are wide open. But that little pilot light never gave out. And if there's one thing I'm grateful for, is that the love never died. We never had to rekindle the love. It was always there. And because of these programs, we were able to put it back in the right direction. But we knew we loved each other, and we dated for 5 years. And during this time, you know, we talked a lot about, if we get married now, it's going to be for good, period. Come heck or high waters, we're going to stay together. We didn't want children brought into this world who would have to live with divorced parents like we did. So we made this vow that we were going to stay together. And bless his heart, he just didn't know the heck and high waters that he was going to have to go through with this disease called alcoholism. My dad was the kind, when the divorce papers were signed, he didn't believe in alimony. He didn't believe in child support. He didn't believe in birthday presents nor Christmas presents. My dad did not believe in such a thing as buying us gifts to give to our mother for Mother's Day. And so there was just no relationship there. But when Bo and I set the date to get married, the first thing that popped into my head was my daddy needed to walk me down the aisle. You know, that would make sure that this marriage would take. So my dad lives in Birmingham, and his phone number is in the telephone book. And I have a friend in this program today who's been sober 8 years, and my daddy is his boss. Just cracks me up, you know. I don't have a relationship with him, but anyway, I called my dad, and I said, "I'm getting married on April the 30th. Will you come and give me away?" And he said, "Why, sure I will." And like an idiot, I believed him. I really believed him when he said, "Shirley, just tell me what time, where do I show up, what do I wear, and I'll be there." Just like all the other times that I heard him tell my mom, "I'll be home tonight on time. I won't spend my paycheck. I'll come straight home." And you know, we believed him every single time. And so we were at the church that night, and my mom was there, and my brother had just finished lighting all the candles down front, and the music was playing, and it was time to get this show on the road, and no daddy. And I was getting a little nervous, and my mom sort of had that look in her eye like, "Shirley, why did you believe him? He's not going to show up. If he does, he'll be drunk." And about that time, someone said, "Man, somebody's pulled up on the sidewalk," and I said, "He's here." And he was, in all of his glory. And, you know, I never will forget that. Now, he threw open those big double doors at the back of that church, and he walked in. He had this natural glow about him. And he no longer had those brown eyes that he gave me. They were red, bloodshot red. And he took one look at me, I'm standing there in this white wedding dress, ready to walk down the aisle, and he looks at me and just turns around and walks out. Just walked back out those two double doors and got in his car, pulled it off the sidewalk, and left. And I just about died, and my brother came back, and he said, "Oh, come on, pull that veil down over your face. I'll walk you down the aisle. I've been trying to get rid of you for years." And my brother to this day loves to get credit for this marriage lasting 29 years. And, you know, I like to let him think that. I really do. I can get anything I want out of him. But Bo and I started on a journey called the Great American Dream that's taken us through a lot of winding roads and through a lot of dead-end streets and a lot of avenues, but it's taken us and brought us right here today. We started on this journey, and for the first anniversary, we had saved up enough money to pay a down payment on a little house in Hueytown, and that's what we wanted, was a home. And we wanted kids. And on our second anniversary, no kids. And on our third wedding anniversary, Bo gave me a little two-door red Thunderbird. And I thought I was the sharpest little cookie driving from Birmingham to Hueytown that you've ever seen. And one afternoon, a man hit me in that little car and didn't do a lot of damage, just sort of scraped it down the side. And when I got home, I showed Bo the damage, and he said, "Well, I think you need to go to the doctor." And I said, "But I'm not hurt." And he said, "But it's that man's fault, and we don't want you to have a whiplash or something down the road." So the next morning, I went to the good old family doctor that's been in the family for years and years, and he checked me over from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. And when he got through checking me, he sort of tapped me, and he said, "Now, when you get dressed, walk into my office and have a seat. I'll be in there in just a minute." And I thought, he's found something wrong with me. I feel fine. I feel great. And so a few minutes later, he walked into his office, and instead of going around and sitting on his side of his desk, he pulls up a chair beside me. And he pulls it right up beside me and taps me on the knee, and he says, "Shirley, you're 2 months pregnant." And I said, "From the red?" I've always been kind of naive. But I looked at him and I said, "I can't tell, Bo." And he said, "Get him on the phone." And Bo worked in the parts department at a dealership at that time, and I say this all the time, and I really mean it because I love it, but a parts department to me is like an AA meeting. You got a lot of men standing around with a cup of coffee in their hand telling jokes and selling parts and all this, but just having a good time. And so I get Bo on the phone in this parts department, and I hand the phone to the doctor, and the doctor says, "Bo, I have Shirley in my office, and she's 2 months pregnant." And you could hear him, "From the rig!" And alcohol made me crazy. That little wreck's name was Mike. And he was born November the 10th of that year, a little blonde-headed, blue-eyed hunk, the sunshine of my life. And then I had another wreck, and her name is Sissy. And she was born 17 months later to the very day. And I know God did that for me because he just doesn't know I'm good with numbers, so he gave them to me on the 10th. And I need to tell you about Sissy right now because she's a very important part of my life. Sissy is 24 years old today. And she was 13 years old when I got sober. She's been in this program 11 years. She grew up in Alateen. And she's been in Al-Anon for 4 years. And for some crazy reasoning, I don't understand it, she used to pray in her bed at night that I'd die in my sleep when I was drinking, or let her get out of high school and color her gone. She wanted no more part of me in her life ever. And when I got sober and got in Alcoholics Anonymous and I started making amends to these kids, Cece came to me and her dad one night and said, "I want to go to college." And I had drank up college. I drank up the house. I drank up everything we ever had. And she said, I want to go to college. And I said, what do you want to do? And she said, Mom, I want to work with alcoholics. She went to college and got a degree. And she's been self-supporting through her own contributions now. A year and a half. And she is a counselor at Walker Regional Hospital in Jasper, Alabama. And recently moved back home. And I tell you about Mary, Etta, we can get together. But I've told Cece she can live at home till she's 35. I don't care what her daddy says. Cece's a beautiful young lady. She's my little Alateen that you people raised for me and then gave back to me. And we have a dynamite relationship. I wouldn't take anything in the world for her. And I thank each and every one of you for what you've done for this family. I know there's people in this room right now that we've met over the years and continue to meet at conventions. And from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for raising my family for me. Cece took us to the airport yesterday, and she's just a neat young lady. She reads my tea leaves a lot. You know, she knows me a lot better than I know myself. But I'll listen to Cece, you know, when she tells me something, and I thank you for that from the bottom of my heart. When we had these two kids, you know, we had the house and the mortgage and the two cars and the credit cards and everything else that goes along with the great American dream. And when Cece was 6 months old, it was important that I go back to work. And I found a real good babysitter who would love and take care of these children in my absence. And then when the disease came along, Mama Betty took over double time with these two children. I went back to work, and I just so happened to meet with a couple of gals who were members of a social sorority, and one day at lunch they said, how about coming and joining our group? And I never got to do stuff like that in high school because I had to go straight home, and I didn't even go home and ask Bo or the kids. I just said, be glad to. So I joined it. I didn't think it was anybody's business but mine. A very selfish person. And at one of these dances on the Warrior River, right outside of Hueytown, Alabama, on a Saturday night in the summer, with a live band, and Mama Betty safely with these two kids at home, and the lights down low and the moon reflecting across the river, my husband walked up to me and handed me a Tom Collins. And he said, here, honey, drink this. And it was the first drink of alcohol I was to ever have in my mouth. This drink is one I'll never forget. I'll never forget my last drink, and I definitely do not forget my first drink. It was in a big tall glass, and it had a straw, and it had a toothpick with all this fruit on it, and it had a little bit of ice and colored water, and had an umbrella in it. And when I drank that Tom Collins, I also drank that umbrella. And when that umbrella got inside me, it opened up. And I've never been the same since. I didn't get in trouble overnight with this drinking. Let me tell you this, I'm a kitchen alcoholic. I have never been to bars. I didn't run around. I didn't get drunk and get behind the wheel of my car. I did a lot of crazy things that I'm not proud of. My husband had to get me out of an awful lot of scrapes with family, finances, and everything else you want to name it, but I just did all my damage at home in the kitchen. But when I got sick and tired of being sick and tired, I had nowhere else to go but up. And I've done just about everything that any woman has done to get through these doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I paid the price, and I hope and pray I don't ever, ever have to come to again, ever in my life. I found it necessary after realizing that alcohol made me energetic. You know, I found out that alcohol was a depressant until I went into treatment, because alcohol for me gave me energy. Man, I could be super mom, super wife, super cook, super career girl, all rolled up into one with just a little bit of help from a thing called wine. All of you guys who drink wine are winos. I am a wineette. And it just has a better sound to it, you know. wine it. And I drank the pink Chablis. And my last bottle of wine cost me $3.17. And see, it was real easy for me to drink that because I could take that much money out of my kids' piggy banks at night. I could take that much money out of my son's blue jeans pocket, which was lunch money for the week. And I could go buy a bottle of wine. And I kept my wine on the left side of my refrigerator in a clear glass wine decanter. And I kept Mike and Sissy's strawberry Kool-Aid in a white Tupperware pitcher on the right side of the refrigerator. And I was real quick to tell Mike and Sissy, your Kool-Aid is on the right side, Mom's Kool-Aid is on the left side. And I have to tell you that the smallest scar that this disease of alcoholism put on my daughter was the fact that she is 24 years old today and she will not pick up a glass of Kool-Aid. That's sad. That's sad. If she comes to your home and you have Kool-Aid, she'll say, may I have a glass of water? And I wasn't hurting so. I did all the crazy things that I had to do to get in this program. I did all the things that I had to do to tear this family apart. I would work every day and come home and start drinking, and by 7:30 or 8 that night, pass out. It didn't matter if you were there or my mother-in-law was there or what. I just got ready and went to bed. And I realized today that I did to my daughter what my mom did to me in a sense, but along the same lines. I changed places with my daughter. I became the daughter and she became the mother. And see, she could come to me and say, Mom, I need some money for a school project. And if I wouldn't give it to her, she'd go tell her dad what I had been drinking and how much. Later on, this turned into coming to me for money and I'd give it to her. And then she'd go to her dad and say, Mom wouldn't give me any money, and she'd get it from him. And she hated it like crazy when I got sober because she couldn't go to Mom and Dad and tell them the same thing. She said, my financial status has changed a little bit, but I think she's okay with that today. I would come to in the mornings, and I don't remember when Mike's bedroom door started being locked. I guess I could drive myself crazy trying to figure that out, but I would go in the mornings and knock on his door to get him up and go to Sissy's room, and her door would be closed, but it was never locked. And I'd walk over to her bed, and I'd shake her to wake her up, and her pillowcases would always be wet. And I never thought about asking her why. It just went through my mind. Yeah, let's see. I went to bed a little early last night, and she probably took a shower and washed her hair, but she didn't dry it. Sounded logical to me. And one of these mornings, she's going to wake up with a sore throat. I'm going to have to take her to the doctor. I won't get to go to work, and I won't get paid, and I can't drink as much. Never realizing that all I had to do was ask her, why are your pillowcases wet? This is a question I never asked. Later on in my drinking, Bo started sleeping in his big recliner chair in the living room. And of course, I was the kind of alcoholic that I would wake up or come to in the middle of the night and go to the kitchen for another drink. To me, that's insanity. What come to and go get another drink to pass out. But that was my disease. And I would walk through the hall and I would see Bo sitting in the big recliner chair in the living room in the dark, crying. Never thought about it for a minute to ask him why. Just figured out somebody was having a problem at work. That was his problem. He'd have to work that out. I'd go get my other drink of wine and go back to bed. I woke up, came to one morning and looked in the mirror in the bathroom, and I looked right straight at this horrible person that I had become. I had that natural glow all about me that my daddy had on April the 30th, and God, it scared me to death. I no longer had the brown eyes that he gave me. They were just as red, bloodshot as my daddy's were that night. And I looked in this mirror and I said, you know, God, I can't remember the last time Bo has put his arms around me and said, I love you. And you know, God, I cannot remember the last time Mike put his arms around me and said, Mom, you smell so good. And I said, I can't remember the last time Cece gave me a compliment for something special I cooked. And I looked back in this mirror and this little voice said, Shirley, when was the last time you put your arms around Bo and told him how much you loved him? Shirley, how long has it been since you put your arms around Mike and told him how good he smelled? Shirley, how long has it been since you brushed Cece's long blonde hair, which by this time was down below her waist, instead of sending her across the street to Bonnie's to have it brushed? You know, I didn't like to see what I had become. I didn't like what I was. I looked in the mirror and I was 200 pounds and I didn't eat. All I did was drink. And I stayed anesthetized every single day. My family all played ball. In fact, when I met Bo, he was a fast-pitch softball pitcher. And until we were in this program a year, he had a 25-year career of fast-pitch softball pitching. And I spent a lot of times at the ballpark with a hot dog and a snow cone as dinner. A lot of times when my kids were growing up, that's what we had for dinner, was a hot dog and a snow cone from the concession stand. And a couple of times a girl would come up to me and she'd say, "You are the luckiest thing in the world." And I thought she meant because all my family members played ball. And I said, "Thank you." And then, you know, on several nights a week, Bo would be playing on one ball field and the kids and I would be sitting there watching. And one night, Bo and I would be sitting there and Mike would be on one field and Cece on another. And some nights, all three of them would be playing. You know, and I'd run myself ragged just going from ball field to ball field. And one night, a girl said, "I'd give anything in the world if I had what you had." And I looked at her and I said, "What is it that I have?" And she said, "Well, you know where your husband is and you know what he's doing. You know where your kids are and you know who they're playing with." And I never thought I had anything to be grateful for. My family members still continued to play ball during this active alcoholism, and it had gotten to the point that I didn't like going to these games and they didn't like me going. I embarrassed them. You know, Mike would say over and over, "Mom, I am not the best player on the team." He said, "I just want to be one of the guys." And Cece said, "I always fell off the bleachers." And Bo would say, "I forgot to turn my headlights off. So heck, I just quit going. It was just a hassle." And things were rolling on along. And when Mike turned 14, Bo pulled in the driveway one night in his pickup truck with a motorcycle on the back of it. And it just scared me to death. I've always been afraid of motorboats and motorcycles. And I guess because I don't swim and I don't ride a bicycle too well, but I just have always been afraid of those two things. And when Bo walked in, I said, "Whose motorcycle is that?" And he said, "It's for Mike." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, when I was 14, my daddy bought me one, and I bought one for Mike." And I know today that that bicycle might have saved Mike's life in a lot of ways, because at night when I was drinking and passing out and all, Mike would get on his motorcycle and he would leave, and he missed an awful lot of the hell that Cece caught. And I'm grateful for that. He would leave, and his curfew was 10 o'clock, and his mother was always passed out in bed when he came home. But I can guarantee you that that young man was home every night at 10 o'clock on time. But he got out a lot of that went on at night, all the verbal abuse, all of the... that's what I did with my family. I never hit them. You see, my daddy always spanked me with a belt buckle into the belt. And when I had Mike and Cece, I told God, I said, "If you'll just give me one boy and one girl, I'll never lay a hand on them." And I never did. But I could cut them down with my mouth. I could slice them down in a New York minute. And you know, even today with this program, I can revert right back when I get myself into a stinking thinking way. I can cut back just as bad as I did when I was drinking. They were going to another ball game in July of 82, and once more they didn't ask me to go. And that was fine, because I could do what I needed to do while they were gone. And Mike was 15, and he was about a half of a head taller than me, with blonde hair and the prettiest blue eyes. And just as they started to walk out the door, Mike turned around and looked at me, and he said, "Hey, Mom, when we get home tonight, will you be passed out on the floor, or will you be passed out in bed?" And he didn't say it sarcastically. He just made a statement. And he didn't wait for an answer. He just turned around, and out the door he went. And for the first time in his life, I wanted to sleep. laugh his teeth out. I wanted to say, how dare you stand there and talk to me that way? No, man, you'll show me some respect or I'll show you. But you see, I didn't say that. They left, and as the headlights went down the street, I went right straight to the kitchen for, guess what? Another drink. And they say the TV was not on when they left. I say the TV was on when they left. And God tells me that the TV wasn't on. I just thought I was seeing things. But I had a drink in one hand and the telephone in the other, and because the telephone number had flashed across the TV screen, 647-1945. And I picked up the phone and I dialed it. And it was after hours at this treatment center, and the phone rang down in the nurse's station, and this lady named Marion answered, and she said, may I help you? And I said, I have a girlfriend with a drinking problem. And about an hour later, she said, why don't you wait until in the morning, Shirley? And see, what I wanted to do was get the information and get the directions on how to get up there and go up there while they were gone to the ball game. And then come home in 28 days and I'd be fixed. And boy, I wish I could have done that. You know, she talked to me for an hour and I realized I was in a blackout. And what scared me the most was that I gave her my Sears charge card number. You know, I don't give that to anybody. But that night when Bo and the kids came in, I was up. And I had been drinking, but I wasn't drunk. And, I was so excited. I hit them at the front door, and Mike walked in first. He said, oh, Mom, you're up. I said, Mike, I've called a treatment center. I've got to have some help. And he said, yes, ma'am, Mom. Never disrespectful in any way, ever. And walked to his bedroom and closed the door, and I heard the lock. You know, like an ice pick, just click. And I knew he was in there for the night. And Cece walked by and she said, oh, Mom, you're up. And I said, Cece, I've called a treatment center. And she also said, yes, ma'am. Never disrespectful. She went to her bedroom. And then old Bo walks in. And he's in his uniform, you know. And I look at him. And I said, Bo, I've called a treatment center. I've got to have some help. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, Shirley, this is number 1,382. What's different? And he went and took a shower and went to bed. And I was serious this time. You know, it really, I didn't know of anything else to do, so heck, I just went to bed too. And this was in the summertime. This was in July of 82. And got up the next morning, and it was like every morning. The kids, of course, were out for summer vacation, and Bo and I got up, went to work. He pulled out of his driveway. I pulled out of mine. And about 10 o'clock, the phone on my desk rang, and it was Bo. And Bo and I had not talked on the phone since Valentine's Day of that year. This was July now. And I just made the mistake of calling him on Valentine's Day and telling him that I had received the 3 red roses, one from him, one from Bo, and one from him, one from Mike, and one from Cece. And I appreciated him, but if he couldn't send a dozen, not to send any more. Isn't that sad? And when I answered the phone, he said, you really did call that treatment center, didn't you? And I said, yeah, I really did. I have got to have some help. And so he started the ball rolling. And I am grateful to this day that I was able to go to a treatment center. I had drank for so long every day on a daily basis that I don't know if I could have done it cold turkey. I don't know. I know I would have made it somehow. I know girls in my group at home that have, but I needed to be sent away. I couldn't. In the mornings when the alarm would go off, I'd ask Bo, are we getting up or are we going to bed? Now that's how I functioned, or thought I functioned, raising two teenagers and driving back and forth to work every day, and had to ask him in the morning, are we getting up or are we going to bed? That's not living. That's not the great American dream. And You know, I would like to stand here and tell you that I checked into that treatment center for 28 days, and then I came home, and Bo and Mike and Cece and I have lived happily ever after, and that's just not the way it happened. I would like to tell you that I stayed 38 days instead of 28. I knew the cards were against me. First of all, see, I told them for every reason why I couldn't be an alcoholic. In fact, my counselor said I should be in the Guinness World Book of Records. She said, you've come up with forms of denial that I have never heard of. And then on day 10, it was sort of like the light bulb went off, and I said, you know what? I really believe I'm an alcoholic. She said, thank God, now the treatment starts. So I had to stay the 28 days. And I knew my way around that place. But you know, I thank God for that treatment center, because it had something up there called Family Week. Bo calls it Hell Week, but that's his opinion. And my two kids were old enough that they came up. And I don't remember much about the Hell Week, except for one particular session that we had together. And I guess that's the session I really need to remember. And we were sitting in this big room, and the counselor went over to Mike first and said, Mike, what do you want to do with your mother? And he said, I don't know, but now I don't want another mother. I just want you to fix this one. That was mine. I don't want another mother. Just fix this one where she won't drink anymore. Then the counselor went over. Now, he's 15, and he didn't need to be at a treatment center for a week. He had other things to do. He had chasing to do and catching to do, and he didn't need to be up there for a week of his life. But he was there, and the counselor went to Cece and said, Cece, what do you want to do with your mom? And she said, I don't know, but I am sick and tired of being the mother. I want to be somebody's little girl. I am 13 years old, and I'm left-handed, and I don't load the dishwasher right, and I don't fold towels right. And I'm tired of going across the street to Bonnie's when I have a problem because my mom's always drunk. See, I wasn't hurting a soul. I didn't go anywhere when I was drinking. I stayed right there in the house, in the kitchen. And this is what my disease was doing to these two kids that I loved and adored. And then a counselor went to Bo, and the counselor said, Bo, what do you want to do with Shirley? And he said, I don't know. But we are 18 and a half years into a marriage, and we dated for 5, and we ain't going to make it to anniversary number 19. And it just blew me away. You can do anything in the world to me, but don't touch my family. Don't take away the man that I vowed to love till death do us part. Don't take away this little boy and this little girl, the only variety they had at that time, so we had one of each, and I have to have this family. And that's all I remember of Hell Week. Maybe that's all I need to remember. I stayed the remaining days and came home Labor Day weekend, and I said, please don't send me home Labor Day weekend, because that was my biggest drinking weekend, because the kids went back to school, you know, the day after Labor Day, and I'm celebrating. And the counselor said, no, it's time for you to leave, Shirley. So they told me that I had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I said, even on holidays? And she said, we live in Hueytown, and they didn't have a group at that time, but there was a good, strong group in Bessemer. In fact, that group kicked off when I was 4 years old, getting ready for me. And they told me that I needed to start going to this group. There were a lot of old-timers there and a lot of winners. And I said, are there any women? And they said, yes, because, you see, I thought I would be the only female. I don't know what I thought of AA. I thought it was more of men, older men, and I thought that you were going to teach me how to drink and control it. I mean, I don't know what I thought, but that's just the conception that I had, and that all the men would smoke, and I don't smoke, and I'd get red eyes, and Bo would think I'd been drinking, and, you know, all this kind of crazy stuff. And so they told me when I left the treatment center that I had to go to a meeting that night. And like I said, I didn't know they had them on Labor Day weekend, and the family, all of us, met another two couples at the Bessemer group, and we went to our anniversary the day I got out of treatment. And if you're new here, if this is your first convention, if this is your very first Al-Anon meeting or AA meeting here, God bless you. You could not be in a better place than at a convention or an anniversary on your first meeting with the hugging and the kissing and the laughter and everything that goes with it. But we went to this meeting, and I remember on the way down there, Mike and Sissy just talking and having a ball, laughing, and I thought, I don't know when I've ever heard them have such a good time. And we heard two speakers. We heard a male Al-Anon and a female alcoholic. And God sent that female alcoholic for me. You can say what you want to. Other people say that God sent them for them, but God sent them for me. And Marty got up there and she said, I'm an alcoholic. And Cece said, oh my God, there's two of them in this world. You know, I look back on that night, and that was just the very beginning of the journey that we've been on. When we got home that night, and I had been away 38 days, you got to picture this. They didn't even take me by the house first. We went straight to the Bessemer group. Thought I might, you know, chicken out. And when we got home that night about midnight, we got a gallon of sweet milk and a package of chocolate chip cookies, because you see, they didn't serve things like that in treatment. Cookies, that is. And we sat down in the middle of the living room floor, and all four of us talked about something called family recovery. And a bunch of kids running around having a good time called Alateens. Mike looked at them, and he thought they were little bitty drunks. but they were Alateens, and they were having a ball, and Mike and Cece were asked by these two parents that weekend if they would go to Alateens for 4 weeks. And at the end of 4 weeks, if they didn't want to go back, they didn't have to go back. We would discuss it. And so we have a good group at Bessemer, a good strong group. And on Tuesday night, we all went to this meeting, and my kids went to their first Alateen meeting. In a month, we all sat down at the dinner table and talked, and Cece fell for our hook, line, and sinker, and I've told you all about Cece. Well, Mike went to those four meetings, and he said, Mom, I just don't think it's for me. He said, I'll support you in any way. I'll go to every night that you get a chip, and I'll especially go to the conventions with you and Dad at the beach. But he said, I just don't think that's for me right now. But let me tell you, Mike had a program. There were a lot of days in from school, he'd grab Cece and say, come in here in my room, I need to talk to you. And he had all the Alateen literature. And Mike had a program. And let me tell you why. When you live in active alcoholism, everybody under that roof is affected. I don't care if it's a parakeet, the fish, or what, you are affected. And when you get in recovery, when you live in a home where the program is practiced, you are affected. And my son had breakfast and dinner with his family, who were, three of us were going regularly to meetings, and that son of mine was definitely affected by this program. He did have a strong program. You know, it rolled on along, and my mother and I had not had a relationship for a long time. And when I first came into the group, I guess I picked this lady. Well, she picked me and came to me and said, Charlie, the first thing you need to do is start making amends to your kids. And I said, that's not the way the steps read. And she said, well, we're going to do things a little different. You've hurt your kids the worst. And they're 13 and 15. They need some amends made now. And she said, we're going to start working on those amends to Mike and Cece now. So we did. And I did it all wrong. I want to tell you, I did everything wrong. I started trying to buy their love. If any of you are having some problems with your kids right now, don't try to buy their love. I would go shopping and see a blouse or a shirt for either one of the kids or a tape or something, and I'd buy it and wrap it up, put it under their pillow. Or I'd put a 5 or a 10 under their pillow. You know, just anything. Of course, Mike liked it. And I remember one night the two of them came to me and said, Mom, we want to have a little talk with you. I said, okay. And Mike was a spokesperson, and he said, Mom, we appreciate all the things you're doing for us, but if it's to pay back for all the crap when you were drinking and passed out drunk, forget it.
you don't owe us anything. If you'll just stay sober today, you don't owe us anything. Wow. God, if some of the amends I had to make after that were that easy, you know? But Mike and Sissy said, we don't want paybacks. All we want you to do, Mom, is not drink. And so I reported back to Katie that I'd been making these amends to the kids and what I had done with the money. And she said, well, they probably liked it for a while. And then they knew it was not right. And then my relationship with my mom had not been on a real good foundation. My mom found out she had the very same thing that my grandmother had, the cancer. And my mom was sick for an awfully long time before she called me and told me that she had the same thing. And I went back to a meeting one night and I told Katie, I said, my mom is going to die if she doesn't go on the kidney dialysis. And she said, well, now we need to get making these amends to your mom. And I said, but my mom knows that I love her. And she said, well, what your mother needs to learn is that she is loved by you because you are her daughter, not because she's dying of cancer. Said, it's going to be really difficult for your mom to lay there and think that you're doing all this stuff for her because she's dying. That your mother needs to know that you love her because she's your mother and you're her daughter. So I'd go to meetings at Besma Wednesday night at the closed meeting after I'd be with my mom. And my mom was on kidney dialysis Monday and Fridays, and I never missed a time. I never missed a time. If Bo and I were going to a convention, we'd go by the hospital and hook her up on her machine and then we'd leave. But I never missed a time. And there was a time in my drinking when my mom said to me over the telephone, I was very drunk, and she said to me, of my three children, you're the sorriest. And Mike and Sissy deserve a better mother than what they've got. And I wouldn't count on you if you were the only thing I had to count on. And she hung up. And then I got into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started trying to mend some bridges and fences that I had messed up. And I can remember one night at dialysis, my mom said to me, I understand you're getting a 5-year chip in a couple of months. And I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, do you think your group would let me give it to you? I said, I believe they would. And so we started making plans, and I was all excited, you know, because my mom was going to give me my 5-year chip in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then one night at dialysis, she said to me, of my three children, Shirley, you've turned out to be the best. Mike and Sissy couldn't have a better mother if they searched the whole world over. And of my three children, Shirley, you are the only one who has stood by me every time I have hooked up to this machine, and I love you. And you see, what my mom did to me was make an amends, and I didn't deserve it. I had these amends that I had to make to her, and I didn't like it, you know? But my mom made an amends to me because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This year that I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, my son flunked his junior year in junior high. And I had a hard time with that. And this whole time of recovery, I couldn't look him in the face, really and truly look him in the eyes, because I had taken away a year of his life. And Mike graduated in 1986, a year later than he was supposed to, and my mom and everybody else was at our home for a graduation party. And Mike got a little nervous, and he called me into the bedroom, and he said, I need to talk to you for a couple of minutes. And I said, okay. And I thought he was going to hit me up for a loan. But he called me into his bedroom, and he said, Mom, close the door. I want to tell you a couple of things. So I closed the door, and I sat down on the bed, and he said, three things I want to share with you. I said, okay. And he said, number one, I want to thank you for being sober. Now, how many of you have heard your son say, thanks for being sober? And he said, I see Cece telling you that all the time, but says, you know, we guys just don't know how to do that real well. And I said, you're doing a darn good job of it right now. And he said, I wouldn't have this party tonight if you were drunk. And I want to thank you, Mom, for being sober for me. He said, number two, he said, for a long time, You and I have had a glass wall up between us because of the year I flunked, your last year of drinking. And he said, we need to set the record straight right now. I used your drinking to flunk. I used it as an excuse. Sissy didn't flunk. She made the AD honor roll. And he said, Mother, in just a few minutes, I'm leaving to go to the stadium. In an hour, I'll have my diploma from high school. And he said, I want to tell you, when I get that diploma in my hand, there's not ever to be one mention, any word mentioned, of the year that I flunked in junior high. Is that understood? I said, yes, sir. And I thought of the promises in the big book, and I thought of all the times I had seen these things start happening to girls in my group, and I thought, they'll never happen to me. Because, you see, I had an awfully hard time with thinking of myself as junk for so long that I didn't deserve any good to happen in my life. And I thought of these promises, and I started to stand up, and Mike said, wait a minute. I said, there was a third one. I said, it don't get any better than this. And he looked at me with that beautiful smile, and he said, no matter how many little girls I date, Mom, you'll always be my number one girl. Well, I didn't need any transportation to the stadium. My mom was there, of course, and she was so proud. And we saw Mike get his diploma, and when he walked across the stadium, he put his thumbs up. And I want to tell you that there was never, ever another word mentioned about that year that he flunked. That glass wall went down. And that glass wall went down because of a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and Alateen working in our home. Cece finished the next year, and she didn't call me into her bedroom. I was kind of disappointed. But you see, what happened with her was she got into Alateen. We had our little nitpicky stuff 7 months into this program because her sponsor said she had to get out all the garbage. And so Cece and I had our little time together early on in this program because she was working her Alateen program full time and I was working my AA program. But when she did graduate, you know, she was proud and she had the same trip that Mike had to Florida, but we just didn't have that one-on-one. The year that Cece graduated was the year that that I was going to get my 5-year chip. And Cece graduated on June the 4th, and on June the 26th, my mom died 1 month before my 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went to the club that night with everyone knowing that my mom was supposed to give me my chip. And time got closer, and my daughter went up on the platform, and she said, I'm going to fill in for a little lady who had a date with God. My grandmother was going to give my mom her 5-year chip, but God wouldn't wait. And just as Cece presented me with my 5-year chip, Mike walked into the door of our group at Bressman. And I got my 5-year chip. After the meeting, Mike came up to me and he said, Mother, you're 5 and I'm 20. Now, do you want me to slow up just a little bit or do you want to speed up just a little bit? And I said, well, I think I'll pedal just a little bit faster. And this next 6, 8, 9 months was really terrible after losing my mom. Because, you see, she was my very best girlfriend in this program because of this program. And it was really rough on Mike. He was the only grandson. And the two of us together had a rough time losing my mom. Cece had gone away to college for her first year. And in May of 88, the Mother's Day weekend, Mike moved her back home. He just insisted on moving her back home. He wanted to scope out all the girls on her dorm floor. And he went down and made 7 or 8 trips and moved her back home. And this year that she was in college, Mike and I had had a date on Tuesday nights. Bo worked late, and Mike and I would meet and have dinner together. And I wouldn't take $1 million for that. I would not take $1 million for that. We would meet at a restaurant in Hueytown, and I'd get out of my car, and he'd get out of his, and we'd go inside, and all these little girls would come around and say, Mike, you need any more tea? Or, Mike, is there anything? And finally, he called them over one night and said, look, this is my mother. And they never bothered us anymore. this weekend in May, that Sissy moved back home from college, this Tuesday night, her first Tuesday night home, we decided to not have the date of going out to dinner since she was home. And I went to my meeting at Bessemer, and Mike had his date, and we would meet back home that night. And when I got back home that night, May the 17th, 1988, Bo and Cece and I were to open the door at midnight to three policemen to tell us that Mike had been killed instantly by a drunk driver. And I had been in this program almost 6 years. I had 11 months previously to this buried my mom. And I'd been on a lot of 12-step calls with girls who didn't really want to live, you know. I've read a lot of things in this book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had things at this treatment center that'll never be taken away from me that I learned one-on-one. But the only thing I could think of when I saw those three men standing there was, why me, God? Why me? For the past 6 years almost, I have done everything that someone has suggested that I do. Which step, God, which step did I mess up? Which step did I skip? Which girl at midnight did I not go pick up and bring back to my home? Which time did I not want to go? You show me, God. But not Mike. You cannot take Mike from me, the sunshine of my life. He was the only one who said, my mom might have drank a little bit, but my mom's not an alcoholic. You see, I had to have him. He was my firstborn. Within 30 minutes, Al-Anon and AA and Alateen was in our home, and nobody left. Nobody left. I can remember my stepdad at the funeral saying, if your mom had not died of cancer 11 months ago, she would have died of a heart, broken heart from losing Mike. And I said, that's not right, Pete. He said, oh, yes, ma'am, it is, too. Told me that just a couple of weeks ago too. I don't remember the first 72 hours after this, except the girls at Bessemer came over in shifts of 3 hours, and I would either lay down or go from one room to another or outside and sit on Mike's motorcycle or something, and I'd look around and there'd be a girl and I'd say, what are you doing here? And she'd say, I don't know, this was my 3 hours. I would get her up to go to the bathroom, and there'd be one with me in the bathroom, and I'd say, please, you know, the morning of the funeral. I wanted to go in and take my shower by myself, and this girl there named Lillian, God, I love her to death, she said, let's go in here and we'll get your shower. And I said, I'm going in by myself. And she said, oh, no, you're not either. And I said, please, you know, I'm a grown woman. And she said, I'll just go in here and sit and wait on you. And I said, look, I'll pay you $50 if you will let me go and take a shower. And she said, well, let's see, let's make a deal and it won't cost you anything. I'll leave the door halfway open and I'll just stand right outside here. And I said, well, if that's the best that I can do. Because see, there was nothing in that bathroom except a radio. I mean, now, well, I'm going to do anything but just take a shower. And she said, okay, so you have 2 minutes, you know. So I go turn the water on, and I'm stepping into the shower, and all of a sudden I start screaming and hollering. And she walked in, and I never will forget her look. I had stepped in the shower with every stitch of clothing on. And she said, now do you see why you cannot be left alone? And I said, I won't buck you anymore. My daughter came up to me at the funeral. And she said, I used to lay awake in my bed at night when you were drunk. And I'd say, God, let her die in her sleep. Or let her get in the car to go buy one more bottle of wine and let her forget where she lives. But God, get her out of my life. And Cece came up to me and she said, I'm going to tell you something, AA lady. You are going to make it. Do you hear me? I am an only child now. And she said, I deserve 100% of you and 100% of my daddy, and I'm going to get it. Do you understand me? And I said, yes, ma'am, I do. That's the way Cece has been for the past 5 years. She's picked me up when nobody else could. When it got time to go back to school, I said, if you'll stay at home and commute back and forth, we'll buy you a new car. And in her outing program, she learned a few things. She said, I'll take the new car and live on campus. But she told me then, she said, Mom, if I don't go back now, I won't go back. And she said, I'm going to go back this first year for Mike. For Mike. And then as she went back and stayed back, she stayed on at school for herself. And then she got her degree, and now she's a counselor in an alcohol and drug unit. It's been 5 years. It's been five awful long years. People still ask us, how are you handling it? One day at a time. It's difficult for me in the springtime when I see motorcycle riders. It's difficult for me to walk into a store and see a good-looking red or royal blue shirt on a mannequin. You know, I want to buy it. It's difficult any time when you lose someone like we lost Mike. What we've decided and what we've both come up with, you know, there's no reason. You can't understand a death, and we can't. The only thing we can figure out is this. Mike would have been 25 years old. And Bo and I have decided that 26 years ago, God was up in heaven, and he said, you know, I got this little blonde-headed, blue-eyed boy named Mike, and he's going to have a little sister named Cece. Now, I need to have a couple that's going to stay together come heck or high waters. And I need to put these two kids with a family who's going to get through a disease called alcoholism, but they're going to be okay. And what I don't understand today is why God picked me and Bo to be Mike and Cece's mom and dad. That had to be something mighty special. We've been privileged with being Mike's mom and Cece's mom. There are a lot of things I don't understand. I know that as long as I keep coming back, I'm always going to keep getting better. I know that I get my battery charged and my oil changed every time I go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, whether it be an Al-Anon convention or an AA convention or at my home group. And I know this for sure. I can tell you without a doubt, that God put three hunks in my life. Three hunks in my life. My number one hunk is my husband, my best friend, my rebuttal person tonight. The second hunk in my life is the little blonde-headed, blue-eyed angel named Mike, who I don't think knew what a resentment was, and just wanted his mom to stay sober. That's all he ever wanted. The third hunk in my life is a young man who recorded a song that will sum up Shirley Temple in one little verse. His name is Ronnie Millsap. And I'm going to close with one verse of the most precious songs in my life. And it goes like this. What a difference you made in my life. What a difference you made in my life. You're my sunshine day and night. Oh, what a difference you made in my life. And that's my AA. Thank you, and I love you.